At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is a Hat Trick podcast.
Oh, lovely.
Hello, Armand.
Hello, Jimmy.
So we're back again, and we're revisiting one of our favourite poets, Horace.
Quintus Horatius Flaccus.
Correct, to give him his full handle. And when was he alive?
This is the 1st century BC. Mm-hmm. This is the switch over from the Roman Republic to the Roman Principate. Mm. So Horace lives through that.
But terrible times.
Horrible times, civil war, where you have Augustus and the Republicans, those who wanted to restore the Roman Republic as it was before Julius Caesar became dictator, fighting the Caesarians, those who wanted Caesar's side to come out on top. And Horace actually fought for the wrong side, i.e. the side that didn't win.
Augustus didn't do away with Horace in some awful purge. He let Horace live.
That's right. Horace basically switched after the Battle of Philippi when he writes an ode about it in which he self-deprecatingly says, "And I threw my shield away." This was considered to be, you know, one of the most cowardly things you could possibly do in a battle. You had to come off the battlefield with your shield, or as the Spartans said, with your shield or on it. He threw his shield away when he was fighting against the man who was then Octavius, who became Augustus, the first emperor, the first princeps. So Horace switched to his side, partly thanks to Augustus's right-hand man, Maecenas.
Yes.
So he was the man who wanted to promote the arts, and the great poets like Virgil and Horace came under his aegis, and Augustus was very friendly with Maecenas, and Maecenas brought Horace into Augustus's circle. And Horace then became fervently Augustan. And arguably, some of the poetry he then writes is exactly the kind of thing that Augustus wants to promote for his new regime.
So that teases up very nicely, because we're going to discuss this week a poem he wrote about war, in the sense of it contains the great line, "Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori," which means
it is sweet and glorious to die for one's country.
So it's an invocation of patriotism, that you put your life at risk to protect the fatherland or the motherland. And why would he write this poem?
Right. Well, this is one of a series of poems that Horace writes in the third book of his Odes. So there are three books of these short poems that were put into the public domain in 23 BC. And odes are short poems in Latin in very complex meters, rhythms, which were adopted almost solely by Horace from ancient Greek lyric poems of 5 centuries earlier. But these are short poems that are meant to be about love and drinking and parties.
My image of Horace is he writes poems that begin with "Nunc est bibendum," now let's get pissed, and "Carpe diem," let's live for the day. But he had other work to do.
Well, you mentioned "Nunc est bibendum." Now it's time to drink, because, well, that is the beginning in Book 1. That's Odes number 37 in Book 1, the so-called Cleopatra Ode. It's time to drink because the deadly enemy of Rome has been killed. But that is a direct translation of the Greek of Alcaeus, in which he says, now it's time, to get drunk, because the tyrant is dead. And this is a tyrant on his island of Lesbos in the city of Mytilene. The tyrant Pittacus has been killed, and Alcaeus writes an ode about it. So actually, the Cleopatra Ode is a political ode, and Horace has got a precedent for writing politically motivated poetry. But when Horace does so in Book 1, for example, he excuses himself. He says, actually, I'm not the person to talk about that. My lyre, he says, should be plucked with a lighter plectrum. So that's a figurative way of saying that it shouldn't be about heavy matters.
Yeah, yeah. Keep it light, Horace.
But he says, I'm not going to write about that. You, he says, Varius, and Varius is another poet whose work is lost. He says it's much more suited to you. So the word for that in Latin, excusing yourself from writing about something, is recusatio. So you recuse yourself from writing about heavy themes. So Horace does this throughout books 1 to 3, off and on. But in book 3, very unusually, he begins with 6 quite magisterial odes, all in the same meter. And they're sometimes called the Roman odes because they very specifically deal with subjects to do with the state and civic virtues and military virtues. And the second of these odes in book 3 is one which begins, the young man who is ready to undergo harsh austerity will fight the Parthians, will fight wars in which he has to sleep on open ground and so on. So he's bigging up the idea of military service. And then he begins the fourth stanza of this ode with the words, Dulcet decor est pro patria mori, which is the Latin way of saying it is sweet and glorious to die for one's country. Dulce is sweet. What does that mean? I mean, not literally sweet, but sweet in the sense that you will be remembered by poets for being a great soldier. So there's this thing in the ancient world where the memory of heroism is something that young people want, young men, and that it gives a certain glow to their lives to be remembered as having fought and died as a patriot. So, dulce, et decorum, and that's the other word. We get the word decorate, decorate a soldier. Decus means glory. So glorious is one way of translating it. It is glorious to die for your country. It can also mean fitting because...
It's the right thing to do.
The right thing to do, yeah. It's the decent thing to do. That's where we get our word from, decet, it is right. So it's both a pleasant thing, amazingly, and a fitting thing to die pro patria, for your country. And he goes on to say, death even catches up with the fugitive. Mors et fugacem per sequitur virum. Nec parcit in bellis, doesn't even spare young people who don't like to fight. It will pursue them and it will get them in the back and in the hamstrings, he
Cowards says. Get shot in the back.
Yeah. So you might as well be courageous because either way you're going to get killed in war. You may well get killed anyway. But what you want is to glow with glory, if that is the case.
So this poem, can it be seen as a kind of almost as part of a recruitment drive? Because clearly Augustus wants to consolidate the empire, to expand the empire. He needs men for that. He needs legionnaires. He needs weaponry. Is this a kind of your country needs you kind of call to arms, this poem?
I wonder if it might well be that. I mean, I haven't come across that particular interpretation of it.
But if you're a young man and you're reading it.
Yeah, I mean... Who is reading these odes? Good question. I mean, Horace is writing for an elite. He's writing for an elite circle. He's probably writing to a degree for Maecenas and Augustus. He wants them to approve the kind of thing he's writing. Although he says in the beginning of the first ode in book 3, Virginibus puerisque canto, I am singing for young women and young men. So that is who these are aimed at.
It's a young audience.
It's a young audience. I mean, interestingly, he says girls as well as boys. And a lot of these first 6 so-called Roman odes are more about morality than they are about politics. So it's about behaving in the right way. And so this one clearly is specifically at young men for whom the right kind of behavior would be to show their manhood. A word in Latin, of course, is virtus. Vir means a man. Virtus is where we get the word virtue. Their excellence. And so that word is repeated in this second ode, virtus. That's what will get you places.
So it's more about these 6 Roman odes, more about how to be a proper Roman.
Yes.
Which is also, I mean, when you think of the culture wars that are going on now, I guess Augustus does want to imbue his young demographic with the values that are going to sustain the empire going off into the future.
That's exactly what
he doesn't
want
them sitting on their asses eating grapes all day, does he? Like he's probably doing.
Well, he doesn't want them getting involved in affairs and things of that kind at the expense of their military usefulness. And he wants them to feel that it is a good and virtuous thing to be patriotic, to fight, and even to die for their country. So, yes, I do think that this is somewhat a propagandist approach by Horace. I mean, how do you get your rule endorsed? If you're a ruler in ancient Rome, you get poets to write about you. You get Virgil to write an epic, which, of course, Virgil was doing in the 30s, roughly the same period.
It's a form of advertising, isn't it, really? It's a kind of
it is a big form
patronized of art. I mean, they're brilliant artists, so the Aeneid is a brilliant piece of work. It also contains very positive messages about the current regime.
Yes. And Augustus wants Horace and his other poets to write about him. This is a tradition that goes back all the way back to ancient Greece, where you have poets extolling rulers for being great and merciful and all sorts of other things like that. Anyway, Horace seems to have succumbed to that in Book 3. So by this time, perhaps in the mid-20s BC, he's decided that Augustus is the man to bring back the stature of old Rome.
Make Rome
great again.
Great again.
Exactly.
Now, are these six poems, are they buried in the larger work? Are they kind of buried there and people come across them by accident and it's kind of by stealth?
I wouldn't say that these six odes are buried in the corpus of Horace's Odes, Books 1 to 3, because they're very prominent at the beginning of the third book. But very significantly, I think, after the first six odes, ode number 7 goes right back to being a light ode about love and even about adultery. I mean, he's telling a woman whose husband has gone off travelling, don't worry, he might well be dilly-dallying out there, but you too have a neighbour who's keen on you. I mean, that's what poem 7 is saying. So after all this...
That's more like it, Horace.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. After all this grandstanding about you've got to be a good soldier and you've got to be like Regulus, we suddenly revert to the old Horace, who's really more interested in sexual peccadilloes and writing about that kind of thing with tongue-in-cheek, obviously. But it is a very stark contrast to what has gone for. In fact, the last of the six odes, the so-called six Roman odes, ends with an incredibly downbeat stanza in which he said, every generation is worse than the last. Our fathers were worse than their fathers. Mm. We are worse than them. And our sons will be worse even than us. So it's as if he's actually saying there's an inevitable kind of sense of decline. And this is, you know, the very last comment of these propagandist odes. And people have said, well, what's going on here? Having told us that we've got to be heroic and virtuous and military, now he's saying it's not going to happen. Or is he saying, if you're not careful, this is what will happen? Of course, that's one way of interpreting that last stanza. It's very gloomy about the future.
He sounds like a reform voter.
There is a bit of that. He was saying, you know, things aren't going to get any better, but vote me in.
This notion, this concept of dulce et decorum est pro patria mori, it is sweet and right or glorious to die for one's homeland. It stood the test of time up to, I'd say, the First World War. I mean, I think people did seem to feel as though
Absolutely.
To fight for one's country was a great and glorious thing. And then
they all signed up in their hundreds and thousands.
And then the first industrialized war happens in the earlier part of the 20th century. And things change, don't they, a bit?
Well, you get this incredible Wilfred Owen poem, which takes this phrase, which, of course, Horace meant completely unironically, and turns it into an ironic expression of how awful it is to die.
Shall we hear the poem?
Let's do that.
Shall I give it in my best speaking voice?
Give it your best.
Okay. Bent double like old beggars under sacks, knock-kneed, coughing like hags, we curse through sludge. Till on the haunting flurs we turned our backs and towards our distant rest began to trudge. Men marched asleep. Many had lost their boots but limped on, blood shod. All went lame, all blind, drunk with fatigue, deaf even to the hoots of gas shells dropping softly behind. Gas, gas, quick, boys, an ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time. But someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man in fire or lime, dim through the misty panes and thick green light, as under a green sea I saw him drowning. In all my dreams before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning. If in some smothering dreams you too could pace behind the wagon, that we flung him in, and watched the white eyes writhing in his face, his hanging face, like a devil sick of sin. If you could hear, at every jolt, the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues. My friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie, dulce et decorum est, pro patria mori. So he doesn't pull his punches, does he?
It's a devastating poem.
Yeah.
It's the literary equivalent of Picasso's Guernica. Death in the most horrible way, in gas. Incredibly powerful. And then at the end, you know, you're keen on glory, but, you know, if you really knew what it was about, you wouldn't tell that old lie, dulce decorum est pro patria mori.
I have a personal connection to this story, really, because my grandfather, a young Liverpudlian, signed up to be in the King's First Regiment, the Liverpool Regiment, and his name is James. And his brother, Martin, was younger than him, and he lied about his age, and he joined up too. And I have a letter written by this young guy, Martin, in pencil. And this young guy talks about being in a camp behind the front lines, and he says he can't wait to get up to the front lines because he's going to meet his brother, Jimmy, my grandfather. So the letter is full of excitement and also fear, and the food isn't very good, Mum, and it's a very kind of, in many ways, a mundane letter. And he does go and join my grandfather, and at the Battle of Ypres, he's killed, age 17. And my grandfather actually pulled him in from no man's land. They were fighting together, and my grandfather was awarded the military medal. But in between the wars, the campaign for the veterans and the poppy, my grandfather would not give any money. He was very bitter because the army sent a bill to his grieving mother for the blanket that my great uncle was buried in. So, you know, that kind of story, we think the First World War, it still haunts people, I think. It was one of those wars where people were killed on an industrial scale. And it's interesting, the generation after that war, you know, that's why they say Chamberlain was so desperate to strike some kind of peace with Hitler. He'd lived through the First World War. And of course, there was a famous Oxford debate, wasn't there, in 1933. Where it was a king versus country. It was,
yes,
this house would not go to war. It was something like that.
Yes.
And it was a great debate. And in fact, the motion was carried. This house voted that it would not go to war in 1933.
And apparently Hitler was quite chuffed by
and
that.
And Churchill was disgusted by these popinjays who were saying they wouldn't fight for king and country. And the newspapers criticised it. And of course, by the end of the decade, over 3,000 young men from Oxford had signed up, and many of them had been killed. So it is interesting that intellectually you say, well, I'm not going to fight. You know, and I was at a dinner recently where someone was banging on about this young generation. He said, if there's a war, because we're talking about Putin and his incursions into Eastern Europe, you know, would this generation fight? I said, well, and I told them the story about the 1933 debate where they were absolutely vehement. It was almost 2-1 in favour of not going to war.
Really? Yes.
And of course, the assumption is that the current generation doesn't have that in them. But the generation of the 30s thought they didn't have it in them and then found it in them. But when is an existential threat to your country? Then what happens? Does it activate something inside one, which then you find that the patriotism wants to have some kind of expression? I was once in Vietnam being shown around by this young guy whose father was in the Viet Cong and had fought for the Viet Minh and the Viet Cong against the French and the Americans. And he said to me in a very humble way, he said, well, we were never going to lose this war. Because unlike the Americans, we were prepared to die to the last person, because this is our home.
Yes. Well, that, of course, is reminiscent of why the Greeks, with much smaller forces, defeated the Persians in the Persian Wars.
Well, you think about Thermopylae.
Yeah. Well,
300 against thousands.
Yeah. However big that army was, but it was much.
Because they must have known they were on a suicide mission.
Yeah, I mean, the 300 held out. They were betrayed by Ephialtes. There's a wonderful Cavafy poem about this, by the way, saying, in your life, he says, you know, one should give honour to those people who in their lives choose their own Thermopylae and stick with it.
That's nice. That's
because, he says, there are those people who are still kind and honourable, even though they know that one day an Ephialtes will come and that the Medes, the Persians, will in the end prevail. So you have to be a good person even though you know you're going to be betrayed. You have to do your duty. in life. And so that is what the Spartans said they'd done. They'd done their duty, they'd obeyed the commands, and they died apart from one. So that sort of heroic story is something that the Romans could look back on, the Greeks doing those heroic things, the Greeks look back on as well. So Horace tells a story about the consul, Roman consul Regulus, fighting in the First Punic War, that is against the Carthaginians, Hannibal and so on. The battle had gone the way of the Romans in 256 BC, we're told they'd won, but then the Carthaginians kept fighting and the Romans lost terribly the following year. Regulus was sent back to Rome, to the Senate, to offer terms, to say, we will make peace. And he advised the Senate not to do so. And yet he had to go back and report. And Horace tells it incredibly dramatically. He says he knew well what the Carthaginian torturer had prepared for him. And yet, with a composed face, he brushed off his wife and children as they begged him, and he walked back to Carthage. He says, just like a lawyer going off to a weekend retreat in Tarentum. So, I mean, this is how the poem ends. But there's this idea of this incredible nobility. It's what's called an exemplary ode. It's about an exemplum, someone who is a model for these young people. This is someone who did his duty despite knowing what the consequences were. And Horace is kind of saying, men are not like that anymore. We need to get back to the great men of old who had this extraordinary virtue, like Regulus, going back to face the punishment he knew he was going to be imprisoned and tortured. There are all sorts of horrible stories about how he was killed by the Carthaginians. I think they put him in a barrel with spikes and rolled him down the hill and that sort of thing.
And the dog barking in the background.
It's my little four-year-old.
Obviously, it's probably agreeing. Is she agreeing with you, or is she wanting it?
The poor old Regulus was very badly treated.
You obviously triggered her by saying Regulus. So when we're looking at this poem, Horace's Ode, Book 3, Ode 2, where would you put it in the constellation of Horace's works? As a poem?
As a poem, I don't think it would count as one of his best poems.
Right.
It's far too preachy.
Is he connected to it in a way? It doesn't feel to me like his heart's in it. He's doing a professional job. He's a wonderful writer of lyric poetry.
Yes,
but
that's right.
It seems to me like he's doing a job. But then he comes up with this sentence, Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori, which we can thank Wilfred Owen. A couple of thousand years later, up pops Wilfred Owen and enshrines it in this ode against war.
Yes. And that's, you know, what we, people of my generation, probably yours, learned at school.
Yes.
And we said, Dulce et decorum est pro patria.
How do we pronounce it, by the way?
Yeah, I mean, as I said earlier, it's Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori, with a short O.
With a slight Yorkshire accent. my teacher, Mr. Cashin, used to say, we don't know how the Romans, but I think you're on safe ground if you do it with a slight Yorkshire accent. So Ibarocum would be York, couldn't it?
Ibarocum. Mori is one thing we do know. It had a short O.
How would Wilfred Owen pronounce, as I pronounce it, Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori?
Well, I think he would have said Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. And mori has to rhyme with glory, of course.
Right, for it to rhyme at the end.
But they certainly said things like dulce for dulce.
Yeah.
It depends whether they were trying to be more kind of Latinate or not. And of course, you could even go Italianate and say dulce.
Dulce, dulce.
Dulce decorum est. So I think we've got decorum, perfectly good English word, lots of decorum there.
So do you think that this poem by Horace, ironically, is being made more famous by
a
20th century
not
poet?
Not that anybody remembers the Horace poem when they think of that phrase.
No.
They just think of the irony of
Well, they
war.
Will now, you know, because you and I have been discussing it for, it seems like, 3 hours. Do you think we've said enough about this poem?
I think we have.
All right, I'll see you next time.
It's All Greek and Latin to Me is presented by Armin Dangour and Jimmy Melville. The producer is Diggory Waite, and the executive producer is Claire Broughton. It's All Greek and Latin to Me is a Hattrick podcast.
Hi, everyone. I just wanted to give a mention to Classics for All. Classics for All is a charity, and what we want to do is provide access to the classics to as many state school pupils as possible. Alongside training teachers who don't actually have to have any previous training in the subject, they hope that they make classics a sustainable part of the school curriculum. If you want to find out more about this fantastic charity, go to the website. It's www.classicsforall.org.uk.